of engagement. Wages. When we see someone poor, it is easy to see their need. When we think of the richest people, we don't really wonder what they need or if they have any needs. If you have all the money you could ever want, what would you buy with it? Perhaps having too much money can be as burdensome as having too little. I would like to volunteer to find out how much the super rich must suffer trying to decide between one super expensive car, house, or jet and another. I wonder if boredom would eventually set in and make you tired of buying things. Would you want to start returning things for a refund just because you are bored? I've been paid a lot for not doing much, and I've been paid next to nothing for working harder than I had ever worked. I've also done volunteer work, which was more satisfying than either of those jobs. When an MCI commercial was shot here in the state, they budgeted way too much money. This is why I got a phone call a couple of months after being an extra in their commercial. They somehow decided MCI was connected with the driving of the Golden Spike in northern Utah, since the point of the commercial was the telegraph operator send the information to the rest of the world. I was just leaning on the telegraph pole, and they recruited me to be another telegraph pole guy. When they finished the commercial and had the extra money, the redistribution began. I got a call asking if I was the telegraph guy, and I clarified I was the one with the mustache. After already being paid $200 for a couple of days' work, the guy on the phone said I was being bumped up to being a featured extra, and would I please sign the contract being mailed to me? I said, sure, and he said he would then send me a check for $3,000. There was a significant pause as I tried to wrap my mind around what he was trying to tell me. Want some money? Sign the paper and send it back. I mumbled I would be glad to take the money. That worked out to over $100 an hour or more, no matter how you calculate it. Should I divide it by the hours I was asleep to, or should I just count the actual hours? That makes it almost $500 an hour. How come I can't get a full-time job that pays like that? Maybe some of you are making that much or more an hour. It boggles my mind. The worst I've been paid was working for the father of a friend. He was a crafty old codger, not really specifying how much I would be paid to heft sheetrock and hold it against the ceiling. He was even too cheap to rent a great little tool which helps lift and hold sheetrock up against the ceiling. If you've never held one of those heavy sheets of paper-covered chalk, it is one of the hardest things I've ever done. When all was said and done, I worked for a couple of weeks for about $1 an hour. Minimum wage at the time was about $3, but what can you do when your friend's dad cheats you out of all that time and effort? You can count it up to experience and write about it later. But I think I may even like volunteering more than being paid a pittance. I've done enough acting for the terrible wages most actors get, and I've also done a lot of acting which I call volunteer work, since I'm not being paid and I'm just donating my time for the good of the organization. I can even write off much of that at a much higher hourly rate on my taxes. I've been in live stage productions where I've actually been ashamed of being paid since the show, the script, or something else was not up to par. In those times, I've even wished it was donated time, since then there might be an excuse for the problems. During those times I've acted for free, I really have enjoyed more of the performances than when I've been paid. But that doesn't mean I'll be turning down compensation, small as it may be. I just won't be as happy about it. It doesn't make any sense. But you've probably had the same experience with your volunteer work. Nothing is so satisfying as doing something good and not expecting a return. It may be more valuable than anything else we could do. Think of it this way. If you could have all the money in the world, or all the blessings in the world, which would you choose? You are listening to Abundance. That was Wages from Rules of Engagement. Today on Abundance, you'll hear selections from Literature Out Loud, plus some homespun philosophy by Marcus Tenacious Noggin. Selections from The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes and A Grimm's Fairy Tale. Welcome aboard. That melodic tune must mean it's time for another episode of Philosophy by Marcus Tenacious Noggin. I do have an extraordinarily large head, and I do stick to a point, even when others might wisely give up long before I do. That might be why my mama named me Marcus Tenacious Noggin. Empty noggin at your service. Welcome to Leap Year. You also get to enjoy Leap Day this week, which I call work an extra day for no pay day. Not me, of course, but most of us sheeple will go to work on Leap Day not thinking about the fact that we are working an extra day we didn't work last year for the exact same pay as last year. Did you get a raise this year equal to another day's pay? Well, then you're working for free. I work on a contract of so many days a year, so my daily rate stays the same. I'll finish working in the exact same amount of days as I did last year, but I'll be done a day earlier this year. I won't get paid any more money, but I'll be done a day earlier. Just another day to sit back and enjoy the sunshine and contemplate the money I'm not making that day. But at least I won't be working. But most of you will work that extra day for free. My salary stayed the same, but yours will go down 1/260th if you work 52 five-day weeks in a year. If you make $100,000 a year, that's about $400. If you make half that, then you gave up $200 this week to help adjust the calendar. But empty, you might be saying. We would be working 52 weeks anyway. It doesn't matter if there's an extra day or two thrown in there. But think about it. You may think you get paid holidays, but maybe it's just another day you're not getting paid. Unless you get extra for showing up that day and working, you're just cutting down the number of days you can earn money. That's what makes me laugh about people getting all excited about holidays. We work from day to day looking forward to those special holiday breaks or to another three-day weekend, but unless you had the choice to go to work and make more money, you're just giving up another day of pay. I'm surprised we don't have more holidays, and most of the people I work with gripe about not having any holiday breaks in March. Or think about it this way. Last year you didn't work on Leap Year Day, and you got paid the same for what you're getting paid this February. Where's the extra pay for the extra day? I know it might hurt your head just thinking about it, but every 4 years, most of us work an extra day for the same pay. Well, here's another way to think about it. If you're on a daily contract like me, working just so many days a year, taking a holiday, which I don't get paid for, means I have to work one day more before my contract is up. Not having a holiday in March means I'm done a day or two earlier than otherwise. This is one of the reasons I hate spring break or hunting vacation or harvest holidays. Beat vacation just means I have to wait until later in the year to finish up my contract of so many days a year. The rest, you don't even think about it. Most of us just go to work every day we're told to and rejoice at the sign of a break, when really, a break should mean we could have the potential of making some more money. In other words, we get happiest when we have to take time off and not get paid. I do believe in time off, but if the time off isn't paid, then it's just sitting around. This does make me jealous of those people who have paid holidays. If you get 2 weeks of paid holiday, those are days you're not working but still getting paid. But the real test would be if you decided to cash those days in, could you still go to work and get paid more? Working's a funny thing. Most of us define our lives around it. We are what we do. We call ourselves bankers and farmers and liars, but mostly we're workers. As long as we show up and do the work, we get paid. Walking around saying you're a liar without doing work equals no pay. So whatever you say you are, remember this week to show up and do the work, even if it isn't lying. You might as well show up and work. If you don't, you might lose an opportunity to be working at all. So an extra day every 4 years don't seem like much sacrifice. On leap day, you're probably leaping straight into a day without pay. Just remember, you heard it here first from Marcus Tenacious Noggin. Just MT to you and my closest friends. Dane Allred. I've had opportunities far beyond what could possibly be expected of someone like me, and if I can do it, you can too. I know you can find the abundance waiting for you in this world. This positive approach has helped me do the things I've wanted to accomplish in my life, and this attitude of gratitude and positive expectations can help you get everything this life has to offer you. Because of the abundance this universe offers me, I want to give back in some small way. We're all on this journey together. And together with what I can do and with what you can do, I know there is nothing that cannot be done. Literature Out Loud, Grimm's Fairy Tales, The Frog King or Iron Heinrich by the Brothers Grimm. In olden times, when wishing still did some good, there lived a king whose daughters were all beautiful, but the youngest was so beautiful that the sun itself, who indeed has seen so much, marveled every time it shone upon her face. In the vicinity of the king's castle there was a large dark forest, and in this forest, beneath an old linden tree, there was a well. In the heat of the day the princess would go out into the forest and sit on the edge of the cool well. To pass the time, she would take a golden ball, throw it into the air, and then catch it. It was her favorite plaything. Now one day it happened that the princess's golden ball did not fall into her hands that she held up high, but instead it fell to the ground and rolled right into the water. The princess followed it with her eyes, but the ball disappeared, and the well was so deep that she could not see its bottom. Then she began to cry. She cried louder and louder, and she could not console herself. As she was thus lamenting, someone called out to her, "What's the matter with you, princess? Your crying would turn a stone to pity." She looked around to see where the voice was coming from and saw a frog who had stuck his thick, ugly head out of the water. "Oh, it's you, old water splasher," she said. "I am crying because my golden ball has fallen into the well." "Be still and stop crying," answered the frog. "I can help you, but what will you give me if I bring back your plaything?" "Whatever you want, dear frog," she said. "My clothes, my pearls and precious stones, even the golden crown that I am wearing." The frog answered, "I do not want your clothes, your pearls and precious stones, nor your golden crown. But if you will love me and accept me as a companion and playmate, and let me sit next to you at your table and eat from your golden plate and drink from your cup and sleep in your bed, if you will promise this to me, then I'll dive down and bring your golden ball back to you." "Oh, yes," she said. "I promise all of that to you if you'll just bring the ball back to me." But she thought, "What is this stupid frog trying to say? He just sits here in the water with his own kind and croaks. He cannot be a companion to a human." As soon as the frog heard her say yes, he stuck his head under and dove to the bottom. He paddled back up a short time later with the golden ball in his mouth and threw it onto the grass. The princess was filled with joy when she saw her beautiful plaything once again, picked it up, and ran off. "Wait! Wait," called the frog. "Take me along. I cannot run as fast as you." But what did it help him that he croaked out after her as loudly as he could? She paid no attention to him, but instead hurried home and soon forgot the poor frog, who had to return again to his well. The next day, the princess was sitting at the table with the king and all the people of the court, and was eating from her golden plate when something came creeping up the marble steps. Plip, plop, plip, plop. As soon as it reached the top, there came a knock at the door, and a voice called out, "Princess, youngest, open the door for me." She ran to see who was outside. She opened the door, and the frog was sitting there. Frightened, she slammed the door shut and returned to the table. The king saw that her heart was pounding and asked, "My child, why are you afraid? Is there a giant outside the door who wants to get you?" "Oh, no," she answered. "It is a disgusting frog." "What does the frog want from you?"
"Oh, father dear, yesterday when I was sitting near the well in the forest and playing, my golden ball fell into the water, and because I was crying so much, the frog brought it back. And because he insisted, I promised him that he could be my companion, but I didn't think that he could leave his water. But now he is just outside the door and wants to come in."
Just then there came a second knock at the door, and a voice called out, "Youngest daughter of the king, open up the door for me. Don't you know what yesterday you said to me down by the well? Youngest daughter of the king, open up the door for me." The king said, "What you have promised, you must keep. Go and let the frog in." She went and opened the door, and the frog hopped in, then followed her up to her chair. He sat there and called out, "Lift me up next to you." She hesitated until, finally, the king commanded her to do it. When the frog was seated next to her, he said, "Now push your golden plate closer so we can eat together." She did it, but one could see that she did not want to. The frog enjoyed his meal, but for her, every bite stuck in her throat. Finally, he said, "I have eaten all I want and am tired. Now carry me to your room and make your bed so that we can go to sleep." The princess began to cry and was afraid of the cold frog and did not dare to even touch him. And yet he was supposed to sleep in her beautiful clean bed. The king became angry and said, "You should not despise someone who has helped you in a time of need." She picked him up with two fingers, carried him upstairs, and set him in a corner. As she was lying in bed, he came creeping up to her and said, "I am tired and I want to sleep as well as you do. Pick me up, or I'll tell your father." With that, she became bitterly angry and threw him against the wall with all her might. "Now you will have your peace, you disgusting frog." But when he fell down, he was not a frog, but a prince with beautiful, friendly eyes. And he was now, according to her father's will, her dear companion and husband. He told her how he had been enchanted by a wicked witch, and that she alone could have rescued him from the well, and that tomorrow they would go together to his kingdom. Then they fell asleep. The next morning, just as the sun was waking them, a carriage pulled up, drawn by 8 horses. They had white ostrich feathers on their heads and were outfitted with chains of gold. At the rear stood the young king's servant, Faithful Heinrich. Faithful Heinrich had been so saddened by his master's transformation into a frog that he had had to place 3 iron bands around his heart to keep it from bursting in grief and sorrow. The carriage was to take the king back to his kingdom. Faithful Heinrich lifted them both inside and took his place at the rear. He was filled with joy over the redemption. After they had gone a short distance, the prince heard a crack from behind as though something had broken. He turned around and said, "Heinrich, the carriage is breaking apart." "No, my lord, the carriage, it's not, but one of the bands surrounding my heart that suffered such great pain when you were sitting in the well, when you were a frog." Once again, the prince heard a cracking sound and thought that the carriage was breaking apart. But it was the bands springing from Faithful Heinrich's heart, because his master was now redeemed and happy. Literature Out Loud, The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes. Adventure 1, A Scandal in Bohemia, from the works of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. To Sherlock Holmes, she was always the woman. I have seldom heard him mention her under any other name. In his eyes, she eclipses and predominates the whole of her sex. It was not that he felt any emotion akin to love for Irene Adler. All emotions, and that one particularly, were abhorrent to his cold, precise, but admirably balanced mind. He was, I take it, the most perfect reasoning and observing machine that the world has seen. But as a lover, he would have placed himself in a false position. He never spoke of the softer passions, save with a jibe and a sneer. They were admirable things for the observer, excellent for drawing the veil from men's motives and actions. But for the trained reasoner to admit such intrusions into his own delicate and finely adjusted temperament was to introduce a distracting factor which might throw a doubt upon all his mental results. Grit, in a sensitive instrument, or a crack in one of his own high-power lenses, would not be more disturbing than a strong emotion in a nature such as his. And yet, there was but one woman to him, and that woman was the late Irene Adler, of dubious and questionable memory. I have seen little of Holmes lately. My marriage had drifted us away from each other. My own complete happiness and the home-centered interests which rise up around the man who first finds himself master of his own establishment were sufficient to absorb all my attention, while Holmes, who loathed every form of society with his whole bohemian soul, remained in our lodgings in Baker Street, buried among his old books, and alternating from week to week between cocaine and ambition, the drowsiness of the drug, and the fierce energy of his own keen nature. He was still, as ever, deeply attracted by the study of crime, and occupied his immense faculties and extraordinary powers of observation in following out those clues and clearing up those mysteries which had been abandoned as hopeless by the official police. From time to time I heard some vague account of his doings, of his summons to Odessa in the case of the Trepoff murder, of his clearing up of the singular tragedy of the Atkinson brothers at Trincomalee, and finally of the mission which he had accomplished so delicately and successfully for the reigning family of Holland. Beyond these signs of his activity, however, which I merely shared with all the readers of the Daily Press, I knew little of my former friend and companion. One night, it was on the 20th of March, 1888, I was returning from a journey to a patient, for I had now returned to civil practice, when my way led me through Baker Street. As I passed the well-remembered door, which must always be associated in my mind with my wooing and with the dark incidents of the study in scarlet, I was seized with a keen desire to see Holmes again, and to know how he was employing his extraordinary powers. His rooms were brilliantly lit, and even as I looked up, I saw his tall, spare figure pass twice in a dark silhouette against the blind. He was pacing the room swiftly, eagerly, with his head sunk upon his chest and his hands clasped behind him. To me, who knew his every mood and habit, his attitude and manner told their own story. He was at work again. He had risen out of his drug-created dreams and was hot upon the scent of some new problem. I rang the bell and was shown up to the chamber which had formerly been in part of my own. His manner was not effusive. It seldom was, but he was glad, I think, to see me. With hardly a word spoken, but with a kindly eye, he waved me to an armchair, threw across his case of cigars, and indicated a spirit case and a gasogene in the corner. Then he stood before the fire and looked me over in his singular introspective fashion. "Wedlock suits you," he remarked. "I think, Watson, that you have put on 7.5 pounds since I saw you." "7," I answered. "Indeed, I should have thought a little more, just a trifle more, I fancy, Watson, and in practice again, I observe. You did not tell me that you intended to go into the harness."
"Then how did you know?"
"I see it, I deduce it. How do I know that you have been getting yourself very wet lately and that you have a most clumsy and careless servant girl?"
"My dear Holmes," said I, "this is too much. You would certainly have been burned had you lived a few centuries ago. It is true that I had a country walk on Thursday and came home in a dreadful mess, but as I have changed my clothes, I can't imagine how you deduce it. As to Mary Jane, she is incorrigible, and my wife has given her notice, but there again, I fail to see how you work it out." He chuckled to himself and rubbed his long, nervous hands together. "It is simplicity itself," said he. "My eyes tell me that on the inside of your left shoe, just where the firelight strikes it, the leather is scored by 6 almost parallel cuts. Obviously, they have been caused by someone who has very carelessly scraped round the edges of the sole in order to remove crusted mud from it. Hence, you see, my double deduction that you had been out in vile weather, and that you had a particularly malignant boot-slitting specimen of the London slavey. As to your practice, if a gentleman walks into my room smelling of iodoform, with a black mark of nitrate of silver upon his right forefinger and a bulge on the right side of his top hat to show where he has secreted his stethoscope, I must be dull indeed if I do not pronounce him to be an active member of the medical profession." I could not help laughing at the ease with which he explained his process of deduction. "When I hear you give your reasons," I remarked, "the thing always appears to me to be so ridiculously simple that I could easily do it myself, though at each successive instance of your reasoning, I am baffled until you explain your process. And yet, I believe that my eyes are as good as yours." "Quite so," he answered, lighting a cigarette and throwing himself down into an armchair. "You see, but you do not observe. The distinction is clear. For example, you have frequently seen the steps which lead up from the hall to this room." "Frequently?
How often?"
"Well, some hundreds of times."
"Then how many are there?"
"How many? I don't know."
"Quite so. You have not observed. And yet you have seen. That is just my point. Now, I know that there are 17 steps because I have both seen and observed. By the way, since you are interested in these little problems, and since you are good enough to chronicle one or two of my trifling experiences, you may be interested in this." He threw over a sheet of thick, pink-tinted notepaper which had been lying open upon the table.
"It came by the last post," said he.
"Read it aloud."
The note was undated, without either signature or address.
"There will call upon you tonight at 7:45, it said, "a gentleman who desires to consult you upon a matter of the very deepest moment. Your recent services to one of the royal houses of Europe have shown that you are one who may be safely trusted with matters which are of an importance which can hardly be exaggerated. This account of you we have from all quarters received. Be in your chamber then at that hour, and do not take it amiss if your visitor wear a mask."
"Oh, this is indeed a mystery," I remarked. "What do you imagine that it means?"
"I have no data yet."
"It is a capital mistake to theorize before one has data. Insensibly, one begins to twist facts to suit theories, instead of theories to suit facts. But the note itself, what do you deduce from it?"
I carefully examined the writing and the paper upon which it was written.
"Well, the man who wrote it was presumably well-to-do," I remarked, endeavoring to imitate my companion's processes. "Such paper could not be bought under 0.5 crown a packet. It is peculiarly strong and stiff."
"Peculiar, that is the very word," said Holmes. "It is not an English paper at all. Hold it up to the light." I did so, and saw a large E with a small G, a P and a large G with a small T woven into the texture of the paper.
"What do you make of that?" asked Holmes.
"The name of the maker, no doubt, or his monogram, rather."
"Not at all. The G with the small T stands for Gesellschaft, which is the German for company. It is a customary contraction like our co. P, of course, stands for papier. Now for the EG. Let us glance at our Continental Gazetteer." He took down a heavy brown volume from his shelves. "Iglo, Iglinitz, here we are, Igria. It is in a German-speaking country in Bohemia, not far from Carlsbad. Remarkable as being the scene of the death of Wallenstein and for its numerous glass factories and paper mills."
"Ha ha, my boy, what do you make of that?"
His eyes sparkled, and he sent up a great blue triumphant cloud from his cigarette.
"The paper was made in Bohemia," I said.
"Precisely, and the man who wrote the note is a German. Do you note the
peculiar
construction of the sentence, 'This account of you we have from all quarters received'? A Frenchman or Russian could not have written that. It is the German who is so uncourteous to his verbs.
It only remains, therefore, to discover what is wanted by this German who writes upon Bohemian paper and prefers wearing a mask to showing his face. And here he comes, if I am not mistaken, to resolve all our doubts. As he spoke, there was the sharp sound of horses' hooves and grating wheels against the curb, followed by a sharp pull at the bell. Holmes whistled. "A pair, by the sound," said he. "Yes," he continued, glancing out the window, "a nice little brougham and a pair of beauties. 150 guineas apiece. There's money in this case, Watson, if there's nothing else." "I think that I had better go, Holmes."
"Not a bit, Doctor.
Stay where you are. I am lost without my Boswell. And this promises to be interesting. It would be a pity to miss it."
"But your client?"
"Never mind him. I may want your help, and so may he. Here he comes. Sit down in that armchair, Doctor, and give us your best attention." A slow and heavy step, which had been heard upon the stairs and in the passage, paused immediately outside the door. Then there was a loud, an authoritative tap. "Come in," said Holmes. A man entered who could hardly have been less than 6 feet 6 inches in height, with the chest and limbs of a Hercules. His dress was rich, with a richness which would in England be looked upon as akin to bad taste. Heavy bands of astrakhan were slashed across the sleeves and fronts of his double-breasted coat, while the deep blue cloak which was thrown over his shoulders was lined with flame-colored silk and secured at the neck with a brooch which consisted of a single flaming beryl. Boots, which extended halfway up his calves, which were trimmed at the tops with rich brown fur, completed the impression of barbaric opulence which was suggested by his whole appearance. He carried a broad-brimmed hat in his hand while he wore across the upper part of his face, extending down past the cheekbones, a black visored mask which he had apparently adjusted at that very moment, for his hand was still raised to it as he entered. From the lower part of the face he appeared to be a man of strong character, with a thick, hanging lip and a long, straight chin suggestive of resolution pushed to the length of obstinacy.
"You had my note?"
he asked, with a deep, harsh voice and a strongly marked German accent.
"I told you that I would call."
He looked from one to the other of us, as if uncertain which to address.
"Pray, take a seat," said Holmes. "This is my friend and colleague, Dr. Watson, who is occasionally good enough to help me in my cases. Whom have I the honor to address?"
"You may address me as the Count von Kram, a Bohemian nobleman. I understand that this gentleman, your friend, is a man of honor and discretion, whom I may trust with a matter of the most extreme importance. If not, I should much prefer to communicate with you alone."
I rose to go, but Holmes caught me by the wrist and pushed me back into my chair. "It is both or none," said he. "You may say before this gentleman anything which you may say to me."
The Count shrugged his broad shoulders. "Then I must begin," said he, "by binding you both to absolute secrecy for 2 years. At the end of that time, the matter will be of no importance. At present, it is not too much to say that it is of such weight it may have an influence upon European history."
"I promise," said Holmes.
"And I."
"You will excuse this mask," continued our strange visitor. "The august person who employs me wishes his agent to be unknown to you, and I may confess at once that the title by which I have just called myself is not exactly my own."
"I was aware of it," said Holmes dryly.
"The circumstances are of great delicacy, and every precaution has to be taken to quench what might grow to be an immense scandal and seriously compromise one of the reigning families of Europe. To speak plainly, the matter implicates the great house of Ormstein, hereditary kings of Bohemia."
"I was also aware of that," murmured Holmes, settling himself down in his armchair and closing his eyes. Our visitor glanced with some apparent surprise at the languid, lounging figure of the man who had been no doubt depicted to him as the most incisive reasoner and most energetic agent in Europe. Holmes slowly reopened his eyes and looked impatiently at his gigantic client. "If Your Majesty would condescend to state your case," he remarked, "I should be better able to advise you." The man sprang from his chair and paced up and down the room in uncontrollable agitation. Then, with a gesture of desperation, he tore the mask from his face and hurled it upon the ground.
"You are right," he cried. "I am the king. Why should I attempt to conceal it?"
Why, indeed, murmured Holmes. Your Majesty had not spoken before I was aware that I was addressing Wilhelm Gottschrick Sigismund von Ormstein, Grand Duke of Castle Felstein and Hereditary King of Bohemia. But you can understand, said our strange visitor, sitting down once more and passing his hand over his high white forehead, you can understand that I am not accustomed to doing such business in my own person. Yet the matter was so delicate that I could not confide it to an agent without putting myself in his power. I have come incognito from Prague for the purpose of consulting you.
Then, pray, consult, said Holmes, shutting his eyes once more.
The facts are briefly these. Some 5 years ago, during a lengthy visit to Warsaw, I made the acquaintance of the well-known adventuress Irene Adler. The name is no doubt familiar to you.
Kindly look her up in my index, doctor, murmured Holmes without opening his eyes. For many years he had adopted a system of docketing all paragraphs concerning men and things, so that it was difficult to name a subject or a person on which he could not at once furnish information. In this case, I found her biography sandwiched in between that of a Hebrew rabbi and that of a staff commander who had written a monograph upon the deep-sea fishes.
Let me see, said Holmes. Born in New Jersey in the year 1858, contralto, La Scala, prima donna imperial opera of Warsaw, yes, retired from operatic stage, living in London, quite so. Your Majesty, as I understand, became entangled with this young person, wrote her some compromising letters, and is now desirous of getting those letters back.
Precisely so, but how?
Was there a secret marriage?
None.
No legal papers or certificates?
None.
Then I fail to follow, Your Majesty. If this young person should produce her letters for blackmailing or other purposes, how is she to prove their authenticity?
There is the writing.
Pooh-pooh, forgery.
My private notepaper.
Stolen.
My own seal.
Imitated.
My photograph. But we were both in the photograph.
Oh, dear, that is very bad. Your Majesty has indeed committed an indiscretion.
I was mad, insane.
You have compromised yourself seriously.
I was only Crown Prince then. I was young. I am but 30 now.
It must be recovered.
We have tried and failed.
Your Majesty must pay. It must be bought.
She will not sell.
Stolen, then?
5 attempts have been made, 2 burglars in my pay ransacked her house. Once we diverted her luggage when she traveled, 2 she has been waylaid. There has been no result.
No sign of it?
Absolutely none.
Holmes laughed. It is quite a pretty little problem, said he.
But a very serious one to me, returned the king reproachfully.
Very indeed. And what does she propose to do with the photograph?
To ruin me.
But how?
I am about to be married.
So I have heard.
To Clotilde Lothman von Sachsen-Meiningen, 2nd daughter of the King of Scandinavia. You may know the strict principles of her family. She is herself the very soul of delicacy. A shadow of doubt as to my conduct would bring the matter to an end.
And Irene Adler?
Threatens to send them the photograph. And she will do it. I know that she will do it. You do not know her, but she has a soul of steel. She has the face of the most beautiful of women and the mind of the most resolute of men. Rather than I should marry another woman, there are no lengths to which she would not go. None.
You are sure that she has not sent it yet?
I am sure.
And why?
Because she has said she would send it on the day when the betrothal was publicly proclaimed. That will be next Monday.
Oh, then we have 3 days yet, said Holmes with a yawn. That is very fortunate, as I have 1 or 2 matters of importance to look into just at present. Your Majesty will, of course, stay in London for the present.
Certainly. You will find me at the Langholm under the name of Count von Kram.
Well, then I shall drop you a line to let you know how we progress.
Pray, do so. I shall be all anxiety.
Then, as to money,
you have carte blanche.
Absolutely.
I tell you that I would give 1 of the provinces of my kingdom to have that photograph.
And for present expenses?
The king took a heavy chamois leather bag from under his cloak and laid it on the table.
"There are 300 pounds in gold and 700 in notes," he said.
Holmes scribbled a receipt upon a sheet of his notebook and handed it to him. "And mademoiselle's address?" he asked.
"Is Briony Lodge, Serpentine Avenue, St. John's Wood."
Holmes took a note of it. "One other question," said he. "Was the photograph a cabinet?"
"It was."
"Then good night, Your Majesty, and I trust that we shall soon have some good news for you. And good night, Watson," he added as the wheels of the Royal Brougham rolled down the street. "If you will be good enough to call tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock, I should like to chat this little matter over with you." Next time on Abundance, part 2 of An Adventure in Bohemia, from the works of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes.